Walt has again given us a very good lead-in for from the Bible study to the discussion. That happened a couple times last week. When Walt asked me if I would lead a discussion on Lutherans in relation to peace and war, I said that sounds a little bit, or it may sound to the guest in the village at that time, like an issue of the past. Well, in a way it is, and we can only look at the past, I guess, when we look for our experience with that issue. And then I was reminded again last night during Dan's Vespers that a lot of what we're dealing with, our most recent memory of that issue, is the images that he was presenting on the screen. How many of you saw that at Vespers? Most of you were there. And it brought back all kinds of turmoil in my own being because I, as I suspect many of you, I was involved directly, even occupationally, with some of that. My background for discussing this issue is really, it's out of Christian social ethics academically, but it's also out of my own experience as a staff person for the Lutherans in this country for 3 years, toward the end of the Vietnam War and the draft, dealing with the issue of conscription. And my desk was charged with relating both to the Lutheran constituency in this country, helping us as church people to understand our own ethic for participation or non-participation in war, and facing, on the other hand, toward the government agencies that dealt with conscription. We were the official Lutheran representation to Selective Service System and to some extent to the Pentagon, although less of that than the civilian Selective Service System, the draft. We worked with them along with other religious organizations in trying to keep humane the guidelines for the way the draft operated, the regs, as they say, and the conscientious objector provisions, which tended to become more liberalized. They have throughout our whole history, but the Vietnam experience took another step forward in liberalizing the provisions for conscientious objection. They did not go all the way, as we will see, all the way as some had hoped they would, or even to the Lutheran official position on the draft, on conscription. So that's the background. There are a lot of peace and war issues we could talk about, but will not. Let me just allude to some of them. One, I think, is disarmament, an extremely important issue these days, but one which we're paying very little attention to as a people, as a society, and certainly as a church. It's almost as though the church doesn't deal with war peace questions unless we're in a war, and then the way we deal with it traditionally is to go along with what the government is requiring. That's been the traditional Lutheran stance, as I see it, throughout history. Walt pointed out when we were talking about this week that it is precisely when we are not at war and when we do not have a draft that we have the luxury of studying without a whole lot of emotion what our history has been, what our tradition is, and even what public policies would be wise for our nation. So that's why we're talking about this morning, because we are not at war and we are not involved in a draft currently. Another issue in addition to disarmament, I think, is the sale of arms. The total sale of arms by the United States to other parts of the world today is about $14 billion a year. That is not only a security issue. We increasingly do that because we need the international exchange that comes from selling arms just as we sell wheat. We need the money to pay for our oil import. We're still running a major deficit, increasingly a deficit in international exchange, a trade deficit. I don't think it's too likely that we're going to stop selling that $14 billion worth of armaments unless we can find some other way of closing that gap, and that's an economic issue more than a military issue, maybe. But it's both security and economics. I think another issue that we probably need to talk about but can't very much this morning is what I think is an over-reliance on military power for security, for national security, as opposed, for example, to investing more in the development of the poor nations or doing more with meeting basic human needs worldwide. We put about, currently, the world as a whole annually puts $400 billion into military security and about, well, less than one-tenth of that into development assistance. Well, as I said, we're not going to talk about those things. We're going to talk about the Lutheran historic stance and behavior with regard to the issue of war participation. Our ethic has basically been that of the just war, or the war, the justifiable war. When is war just? When is participation in war by a Christian person legitimate? This ethic deals with the norms by which war participation may be judged as justifiable. Not a holy war approach, not a positive good, but a kind of lesser evil. I think it is a lesser evil ethic that we're dealing with here. Whatever we do, faced with the prospect of going to war, whatever we do, we will be involved in sin, okay, which is the lesser sin. It grew up as a kind of alternative to pacifism. It's pretty clear, historians tell us, that the early Christians were pacifists, partly because they did not believe in doing violence to others, partly because to go to war in the Roman Empire was to worship Caesar. And the soldier was required to swear some kind of allegiance to Caesar, which bordered on making Caesar God, and that was idolatrous. The just war ethic then began to evolve after Christians became responsible for the civil order, after we became the majority community. And into medieval Europe in particular, and on down to the time of the Protestant Reformation and beyond, the just war ethic has been shaped, refined, and I think, well, until the Vietnam War, in our own American experience, it was the standard ethical basis for war participation for most Americans, Christians or otherwise. The only real exception have been those, and it has not been all of them, but a majority of those who belong to the historic peace churches, who have been pacifists by religious conviction, and then some secular pacifists who do not have a religious basis for their pacifism, but simply believe that any use of violence, war or otherwise, is illegitimate for them. Who can recall what are the historic peace churches, by the way?
Amish.
Yeah, the whole Mennonite tradition, one branch of which would be the Amish. Who else? The Friends, the Quakers?
Brethren.
The Brethren. Yeah, those are the major. Now, the Jehovah's Witnesses are another group, but their basis for refusing to go to war is more like what I described as the emperor worship of the early Christians, the wanting to avoid that. It is more that than it is pacifism. So they aren't considered a historic peace church. But Jehovah's Witnesses believe that any requirement of the state that requires that kind of allegiance, that kind of commitment to the state, is illegitimate. And it isn't only war service or war participation that is on that list for them. Well, let me quickly review what is the just war ethic. It is today usually summarized under 7 points or propositions, 3 of which are called ad bellum, or as you move toward war or as you consider entering war, these are considerations to raise, 4 of which are in bello, or during the conduct of warfare. The first 3 are, number 1, war to be justifiable must be declared by a duly constituted authority. That has usually been interpreted as meaning a state, a nation state. And in doing so, we have in our Constitution a provision for the means by which war may be declared and entered by this nation. Who declares war in the United States? Okay, the Congress. So that became an issue during the Vietnam War. The Congress never really declared war against Vietnam. It has been called a presidential war because it was really entered into gradually, incrementally, through basically presidential actions. You can, in fact, as you review your recollection of the Vietnam War, look at all 7 of these in the light of that experience and see whether you think that was a justifiable war based on this ethical construction or not. The opponents of the war, of course, said it was not. Part of the declaration by a duly constituted authority in the stated ethic is that the government declaring war must at the same time declare to the human family, its enemy and other nations, other peoples, what are its reasons for going to war? What has precipitated this action? And if you recall hearing the declaration yesterday, that's what you got in the Declaration of Independence. It didn't specifically talk about going to war with Britain, although we were already at war with Britain, But in effect, it was a case to the world. It was addressed to the world. And the language says that, addressed to, you know, the common human family, setting forth why these colonies felt they were justified in taking, in breaking with the mother country, and it was implied at least, in doing it with force, going to war to do it. That was the case that they were presenting. Okay, that's the traditional just war ethic at work. That's what you're supposed to do if you want to go to war. Secondly, the considerations leading into war include that it must be, on the part of a particular nation, it must be a defensive action. Aggressive warfare is not legitimated under the just war ethic. The resistance of aggression is, to take up arms to resist aggression or to restore rights wrongfully denied. That's a legitimate defensive justification for going into war. And the third consideration is that it be a last resort. That's an interesting one, because I doubt that any war entered at any time by any people has really been a last resort. At least it's quite hard to find that all other resorts have been explored, all other possible ways of resolving the conflict have been explored. Very often, in fact, once nations are armed and ready to go to war, it seems to me that war entry has become an early or first resort, if not a first resort, at least a resort higher on the list than the very bottom of the list. And I think you could ask, somebody said to me, I think it was Dan Erlander, after the reading of the Declaration yesterday, I think they overreacted, meaning the colonies. Was the justification sufficient for us to take up arms against Great Britain? Well, many historians say today, no. The abuses were not nearly that great. The tyranny was not nearly that oppressive. There are a lot of examples in today's world of far worse tyranny and oppression, where we now say, we who came out of a revolution as a nation, we now say, no, you should not resort to a just revolution. And the debate today, by the way, about this ethic is really not just war, but just revolution. What makes a just revolution? And we may want to talk about that some in the context of Southern Africa and other places on the globe today. Then there are four considerations as you conduct the warfare. Most of these, by the way, have been written into international law through the conventions governing the conduct of warfare, the Geneva Conventions and other conventions. A lot of work was done in this area in the late 19th and early 20th century. It became in part the basis for the Nuremberg tribunals, which tried Nazi war criminals after World War II. There is a body of international law, and some new international law was created through the Nuremberg precedent. But legally, there was some question about whether that was proper, whether the victors can try the vanquished. That was a legal point, and of course a moral point too. But there is a basis in international law for what you may and may not do in the conduct of warfare. Not everything is permissible in war, according to international law. And more or less, the nations have tried to observe that. Let me give you some examples. The first is that there must be a reasonable chance of success. Now, this is kind of a consideration as you move into warfare, too. The example I think of is Biafra. Biafra, in its attempted insurrection against Nigeria in the, was it the early 70s or the late 60s? Late 60s, I guess. Had a lot of sympathy in the world community, but the prospects of success for that revolt were never very high. And as it turned out, I think historians would say today that a lot of needless suffering occurred, and that was an effort that probably should never have been undertaken by the Biafrans. Now you can say, well, what would have happened if? They might not have been able to resolve things within the Nigerian Federation if they hadn't gone to war. But it's that kind of war that is intended by this provision. It must have a reasonable chance of success. Otherwise, you are submitting a lot of innocent people to war and pillage and starvation and everything that comes from war, the disruptions of war, without any chance of having a better situation result. Another one is proportion of means and ends. The violence in warfare, according to this ethic, is always to be limited. It is not unlimited violence. Certain weapons are prohibited. Which weapons under international conventions do you know, or which means of waging war do you know about that are prohibited? Gas, germ, biological and germ warfare, biological and chemical, yeah. What is called what? I'm not sure that's covered by the conventions yet, is it? That is, have nations signed international agreements governing those? They're in the suspected area, the suspected realm. There were a lot of new technologies developed during the Vietnam War that many people have questioned, but I think are not yet covered by international conventions for war. The fragmentation bombs. Some say the new neutron bomb is one that is questionable, because it's the one that's designed to damage human flesh or kill human beings, but not damage property. So there is to be a proportion between the means used and the ends sought, and that led to such things as prohibition of certain kinds of weaponry. Another one is that non-combatants are to be spared, and that is not only civilians. Used to be more possible than it is today to distinguish between civilians and non-civilians. That becomes very difficult in guerrilla warfare. But historically, non-combatants, it was fairly clear who they were. But it was not only civilians, it was also prisoners of war. Once an enemy soldier was rendered defenseless, once he was disarmed, he was no longer a soldier. In effect, he was treated as a civilian, a non-combatant, and was to be treated in a certain way. His health and life were to be protected from that point on. He was to be fed regularly. He was to be housed under certain conditions. Well, nations have not always lived up to those, but there are international agreements governing the treatment of prisoners. And then finally, really deals with after warfare is concluded, but it has to do with the way you prosecute the war, the rhetoric you use during it. It is the point that the victor is to be compassionate to the vanquished. This was questioned in relation to World War II. I discovered later, I didn't know it at the time. I remember during World War II when all the talk was about unconditional surrender. Remember? What are our terms? Unconditional surrender. Well, historically, in the just war ethic, the one who is hoping to be victorious, which would imply both sides, and the one who is finally victorious, is not to talk about unconditional surrender. There are to be conditions, and then you are to be compassionate toward those you have defeated afterward. Well, the United States has found it easier to do that when we are clearly the victor than when we are not clearly the victor or the loser, as with Vietnam, I think. Now, that's a quick review of the just war ethic. There's a lot, books have been written about it, but that's an outline. Now, what I want to do next, and I should tell you what I have in mind for the rest of my presentation. I want to talk about the United States law and the churches with regard to war participation, and then I want to do some personal reflecting, and I hope that you will join me in that out of your experience, your particular immigrant people's experience in this country. Mine is German, and I think that has marked the way we behaved as German Americans, and I'll say something about that. The U.S. law and the churches. Under the law, only those may be excused who object to war as such. Those who say, I will never participate in warfare. It is a conviction of mine. Throughout most of our history, it had to be a religiously based conviction, and you had to demonstrate ultimately to the courts, but first of all to the draft board or the whatever system we had for selecting people for service, you had to demonstrate that your conviction was religiously based. That was reversed during the Vietnam War, so that it became possible for people who did not have a religious reason for being pacifist also to receive legal status as conscientious objectors. That was one of the more liberalizing or more lenient approaches which came out of the Vietnam War. What did not happen out of the Vietnam War, but there were efforts made to accomplish it, was to recognize the selective objector. Now, what is a selective objector? Objection to a particular war. Yeah. And it is based on the just war ethic, which it's a little bit ironic. The ethic by which most Americans, whether they know it or not, are guided when we enter into warfare, the ethic of the just war, is precisely the ethic which we do not recognize when it comes to objection to war. We recognize only the pacifist ethic, which is an ethic shared by very few of us. Right? I think there are some practical reasons for that. It is understandable. It is pragmatic. The fear has always been on the part of lawmakers and military leaders and probably the society as a whole that if you recognize selective objection to war, very few will ever go to war. Now, I'm not sure that's true. I think when the country really feels under attack, I'm not sure about World War II. We can speculate on that in the discussion time. Britain allowed for selective objection, has for a long time, did during World War II. Britain had no trouble raising an army to fight the threat of Hitler. Now, I don't know if the United States felt equally threatened in 1941. We'll never know, I guess. But Britain has felt, there aren't many nations of the world who've risked this, but Britain has felt that you can allow selective objection to war, that is, objection to this particular war, without a need to document or prove that you are an objector to all wars, and still be able to defend itself as a nation. We have not done that. The effort was made late in the Vietnam War, pushed by Senator Hart in the U.S. Senate from Michigan, to introduce, in a revision of the draft law, I think in 1973, to introduce selective conscientious objection, and it got only 12 votes in the Senate. So obviously there was not a lot of support for it. I go into some detail on this because it is, in fact, the position which evolves from our own ethic, including where the Lutherans have been. And during the Vietnam War, all three major Lutheran bodies officially adopted a policy stance which said that is our position. LCA did it in 68, LCMS in 69, ALC in 70. Almost the same kind of language in those three. And that's not just adopting a statement for study of the people. That is an official policy stance of the churches which says that this is what our teaching has always been. Why did we not do it before? I don't know. Why did we do it during the Vietnam War? I think because of the nature of that war. And the fact that even Lutherans had large numbers of young people, young men, as it happened, because only they were conscripted, who were questioning the legitimacy of their participation in that war. And they were not pacifists. They were selective objectors. Well, those were still divisive, and they were not unanimous votes by any means that adopted those in conventions. They were like 60-40 or two-thirds, one-third. And I think if you took a referendum among all of the people in our churches, you wouldn't even have secured their passage. That's my hunch. Because I think, again, we can debate it, I think most Lutherans still don't agree that selective objection is good public policy or good Christianity. That's just a hunch I have. Now, that did two things, it seems to me. The adoption of that policy position by the three Lutheran bodies, it reminded our constituency, to some degree, those who found out about it, because not all official statements adopted by church bodies are ever learned of by the people in the pews. It reminded our constituency, and it reminded the society as a whole, and particularly the lawmakers, and other churches did similar kinds of things, of the connection between this war ethic, the ethic of the just war, and selective conscientious objection, that selective objection is an almost automatic outcome of the just war ethic. It also committed the church, and this was probably more important for the church, it committed the church to surrender. Under God for a Christian individual. The state was saying it is not legal. So you had something the church was saying was moral, which the state was still treating as illegal. And I think there's a difference between morality and legality. But, you know, the crunch came when people who said, I object to this particular war, were told by their government that they were breaking the law. What was the church to do? Well, the church was at least formally committed to surround and support them. And I think to a degree we did that, although it was quite controversial and quite divisive in the church. We put funds and staff for the first time in the United States. We put funds and staff as Lutherans into a ministry which helped both to interpret the position to our churches and to help the young men who may have been in an extra legal position to live. There was a ministry which was in most cases ecumenical to those who went to prison or who were on the way to the possibility of prison, to those who went into exile, even to those who went underground to some extent. They surfaced regularly and sought various kinds of help, and there was legal help and there was counsel, and there was in some cases simply financial support offered to people. There were a lot of interpretive things done during that time. I remember an article in the Lutheran Standard, which I did not write. I don't know who wrote it, but I rejoiced to see it. It appeared about 1970 when the ALC was debating the SCO position. And the title of it was, Luther was a selective conscientious objector. On the basis of Luther's writings, that is accurate. Luther didn't use that term in those days, but that's where Luther came out. Luther has a treatise on whether soldiers too may be saved, I think it's called. I think that's the title of it, in which he addresses this issue, on whether soldiers too may be saved. I think that's the...
The subtitle is, to what degree authority is to be obeyed.
Yeah. And Luther makes a big thing. He doesn't fall back on the perverted Walt Two Kingdoms ethic that you were referring to. Was it your uncle or somebody who said there's God's world and then there's the world of the state? Luther is saying God is active in both realms. God is present in both realms, and we are under God in both realms, both the civil order and the realm of grace, the people of God. And Luther quotes Acts 5:29 in that treatise. We must obey God rather than men. If it comes down to it, and you are convinced that it is not God's will for you to take part in this war, you must obey God rather than men. Well, in that time, it was a pretty serious thing. We haven't killed people in this country for refusing the draft for a long, long time, if ever. We've put them in jail. But in Luther's time, you could get killed by your prince for refusing to go to war when your prince called. But that was Luther's position, and it was based on the justifiable war ethic. Lutheran Council USA did a major study during those years through the Division of Theological Studies of what is the Lutheran witness, the U.S. Lutheran witness on peace, war, and conscience. A lot of things came out of that study, a lot of recommendations to the churches. The study appeared about the time the war ended, so we've ignored it. But I just want to keep it alive wherever I can and call it to your attention. It's available in study group format for those who want to pick it up. I think it's still useful, even though we're not currently at war. Two of the things the study recommended, neither of which we've done, I want to mention because I think they're important and should be done. One was to enter into formal dialogue as Lutherans with the peace church traditions. We've entered into formal dialogue with Roman Catholics, with Reformed Christians, with Orthodox, I believe, with Jews. We have never even talked about having dialogue with the peace churches in this country about the way we variously view the state, the Christian's obligation, civil disobedience, a whole range of questions. I think we don't do it because to most Lutherans it isn't that important. To most peace churches, they would be delighted to do it with us. To a large degree, we come out of common Germanic origins. They're a part of the same Reformation we are, but they're a part of the Radical Reformation. We have some common roots, but we have not formally had dialogue with one another. And I think that would be a good thing to do. I think we would learn from it, and perhaps they would too. Secondly, the study called for the formation of a theological basis, or the articulation of a theological basis, for our ministry in the military. Lutherans in this country have never really done that. The Vietnam War raised a lot of questions about it, largely around the issue of, can the military chaplain, under the present system in the U.S., really be prophetic, that he can minister to individual persons? Yeah. But can he be prophetic about the institution or the system of which he is a part? Can he raise questions about the ethic of war and peace? Well, most chaplains say, no, you can't really do that. And I think in their private conversations, most chaplains say they don't really want to do that anyway because they're not sure that That's what they ought to be doing. Well, then the civilian church tries to do it, and during the Vietnam War, very often the chaplains felt they were being attacked by their own church, and they felt kind of alienated, and there were problems. The point is, we have not, I think, really dealt as Lutherans with that issue of what form should ministry to, with, on behalf of persons in military service, what form should it take? Some of the other denominations have studied that in the latter years of the Vietnam War. The United Church of Christ and the United Presbyterians both did, and recommended some changes in how they conduct their ministry through the institution of the military. Now, let me go to some personal reflections. I come from a family of draft evaders. I think some of you may too. It's way back. My German ancestors came to the United States, at least in part, to avoid conscription in Germany in the 19th century. Hertha's people came more recently from the Ukraine, Germans living in the Ukraine, who were told by the Tsars a couple centuries ago, when the Germans first went there to occupy open land, that they would not be conscripted into the Tsar's armies. In the early 20th century, the Russian Tsars changed the rules and started to draft Germans, and Germans didn't like that. They never felt Russian anyway, and so they came to the United States, to North America.
Wasn't that a Tsarina that made that arrangement?
Maybe it was. I don't know who was actually the leader at the time, but it was early 20th century. Now, the strange thing to us is that Hertha's uncle, who was one of those who came, within 5 years of arriving in South Dakota, was fighting against Germans in World War I, or was in the army, and then later was fighting against them. That was okay, I guess. I don't think that was a conscience problem for him, though I never met the man, but apparently that was all right. What had changed? Why was conscription in this country okay? Well, I think it was because the Germans who came here decided that this was in fact their country, and that they needed to demonstrate by any means possible that they meant to be Americans. Germans, because we didn't speak English, were always considered somewhat suspect, I guess, in the first generation at least. And we had to prove to the English-speaking Americans that we were in fact loyal also. Well, let me come down to more recent times. There was a kind of hysteria about Germanness, at least in the Midwest, during World War I and to some extent World War II. I remember my mother talking about her grandmother, my great-grandmother, in 1917 and 18, violating the law several times a day. Iowa had passed a law making the use of the German language in public discourse illegal. Now, what did she do in public discourse? She used party line telephone, and that was viewed as public discourse, and she was breaking the law, and she didn't care. All she spoke was German, and she was going to continue speaking German. I have no evidence that Iowa ever prosecuted people for violation of that law. Maybe other states that had that law did. I don't think Iowa did. The fact that Iowans passed that law, I think, is the remarkable thing. That the use of a particular language, which was also used by an enemy people, was sufficient cause for putting you on a list of, putting it on the criminal code. It was a felony to use the German language, to teach it, to speak it in public. Of course, the German language in worship was proscribed by that. A lot of congregations were hastened into becoming English-speaking and Americanized by two wars. And maybe in some respects that was good for us German-speaking Lutherans. I think it probably was, because we held on as long as we could. In South Dakota, where my wife grew up, the First World War didn't change that, and neither did the Second World War, because the community they were in was all German, and they didn't have to fear a pressure from Yankees. In fact, in 1943, when she was confirmed in German. That was the height of the war. They still have German services there once a month. That was a later immigration. It was an all-German community. I grew up in a community where the Germans were in a minority, surrounded by Welsh and English people. In 1940, my father, who was a pastor of the old ALC in northern Iowa, was accused publicly of being a Nazi. Now, he was very apolitical. I never learned politics from my father. He just wasn't a political being. He was called a Nazi because he had German services in his congregation. And in fact, the congregation was called the German Church. It had a name, St. Paul's or something, but it was never called that by the community. It was the German Church. He has told me since that one of the main reasons that led him into the military chaplaincy the following year was to prove to those people and to himself that he was loyal. And he knows now that that probably wasn't the best of motivations. But the pressure was so great in that community that people did things like that. And maybe he did have to prove something to himself. He served in Europe through the end of World War II as a military chaplain. I think it was different for Scandinavian Lutherans in this country. We have never gone to war against Sweden or Norway or Denmark. There are Scandinavian background people here who may have a feeling about that. I would like to hear you express it. I think it was different for Scandinavian Lutherans. But there was something that did unite us. The general Lutheran tendency in this country has been, when in doubt, fall back on Romans 13. Not Acts 5:29, but Romans 13. In a kind of, I think, literalist reading, which says, whatever government is there is instituted of God. Now, that's one level at which you can approach that passage. The other level is, whatever government is there is legitimate because order is instituted of God, but that does not mean that every particular policy of that government must be obeyed. We didn't really make those distinctions traditionally as Lutherans in this country. What have we learned from the Vietnam experience? It's hard to say, I think. We're probably still too close to it. Just as each war tends to be fought with the weapons and strategies and assumptions from the previous war, so I think peace and war resistance tends to build on the knowledge and practices and strategies and assumptions of the previous war. So what we experienced through the Vietnam trauma in terms of war participation, I think will shape us for a good time to come. And that's probably good and bad. If there is never another war, which we can devoutly hope, our experience of war will be, our last memory of war will be Vietnam. If there is another war, how we behave in it, how we counsel our young men, and perhaps women by that time, with regard to a draft, will be shaped by our experience in that war. So these are three or four things that I think we may have learned or can expect to have gained for the future out of that war experience. It taught some Lutherans, at least, what our ethical basis for war participation is, that we are part of a Western Christian tradition called the just war tradition. Secondly, it made some room among us in our churches for war resistors. We really didn't have room for war resistors before, as I read history, and I know that was true in World War II. The Lutheran who was even a legal CO during World War II, and we had some of them, was a very lonely individual. Third, it enlisted modest church resources for a ministry to those who say no. For the first time, we put official church dollars and staff persons and structure into that kind of ministry. At the same time that we were carrying on a rather broad ministry to those who say yes, that we had done for a long time. This was the first time we provided an official ministry to those who say no. Four, it detached the church somewhat from national priorities, officially. We also adopted statements questioning the war itself, along with our statements on selective objection. That was quite new in our history as Lutherans in this country. Fifth, it reminded us that the people of God are always in some tension with their own culture and with the civil order, any civil order. I think the Vietnam War helped to remind us of that, and it was a reminder that Lutherans needed to have, I think. Now, as I say, I don't know what we've learned for a permanent on into the future kind of existence from all of that, but I think those are five things that some Lutherans gained and learned out of that experience. I'm going to stop there. We have only about 15 minutes left. I'd very much like to hear what you think about this on the basis of your living through those times.
Chuck, can I just say a word about development that you alluded to? I think it's terribly significant to know that, as Chuck mentioned, the just war ethic comes about only when Christians begin to occupy those offices in which they are responsible for the whole civil order.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, it's an ethic that comes about when Christians become part of the establishment and feel civil responsibility for the whole society. So the early church was, as you mentioned, pacifist. However,
had the luxury, you could say, of being pacifist, because they didn't have to take responsibility for the civil order.
As Christians in the development of the West, in Western Europe, and then to North America, identified their Christian responsibilities in a way that spread throughout the whole civil order, a shift occurred in the just war ethic. That shift went like this. When the just war ethic began, it assumed that when war came about, one was opposed to participation in that war. It gave some criteria by which to measure whether or not there would be an exception to participation in that war. That is, it came about as it assumed that the pacifist stance of objection to participation in war was the normal one, and that there might be some particular war that was justified, or my participation in it was justified. Yeah. As the churches became more and more identified with the civil order, the shift went to this. It assumed that when government called and a war came about, that one would participate in it. It assumed that participation in war was the normal thing, rather than non-participation, and that the just war criteria then lifted up those exceptions to participation, and thus it became selective.
Yeah, and then it became a matter of where within the just war ethic can the individual, the occasional exceptional individual, find a basis for standing.
So it came out of came out of a tradition that was pacifist as a normal bearing, and asked whether there are any unjustified cases for exception to pacifism, and it became an ethic that says participation in war is the normal bearing. Are there exceptions to that?
And given the fact that there will be wars, how can you make them as morally acceptable as possible?
Which is a major shift.
It's been observed that the just war ethic has, as nearly as historians determined, never stopped any nation from going to war.
No.
It has never deterred, but that was one of its original intents in so-called Christian states. Secondly, it has never really been explored in recent times by Christians what would have to happen for the just war ethic to become operative. What circumstances would have to be present for the just war ethic to lead churches and then presumably the larger society to say, hey, this is not a justifiable war on the basis of this ethic, so we ought not enter it.
You ever have the criteria for that, though? You know, that's so much in control of your government, some of that.
Yeah, and you
get it.
For a long time, we believed that the government had more information than we did. They knew best, so we should trust them to tell us if we had to go to war. I want to add to this one point because it's Holden related. Later this summer, John Howard Yoder will be here. He's a Mennonite theologian, the author of The Politics of Jesus. John Howard Yoder has been floating among some ethicists and denominational people a proposal for a year or two. The ALC has said we would put some money into it and provide a person for it. The proposal is this, that the ethicists and theologians of the just war tradition in this country, of those denominations that are interested, or those seminaries that are interested, come together and spend a substantial chunk of time talking together about that question. What would have to happen, what would have to be present for the just war ethic to be operative in the 1970s or the 1980s? Or is it just an after-the-fact kind of ethical analysis that doesn't mean much? John Howard Yoder, who is himself a pacifist, but thinks if you're going to be a non-pacifist, you should also have an ethic. And if your ethic is the just war ethic, what does it really mean? He wants to sit down and talk with Lutherans, Catholics, Presbyterians, and others about that. And I hope that will happen. We've asked a person, and he's agreed, from the Columbus Seminary where Walt is, to serve as an ALC person on that symposium. I just thought you'd be interested in that. Some of you may still be here when John Howard Yoder is here. Now, What other thoughts do you have out there?
Is there anything in the world law that you were talking about that has that sets any kind of limits on arms, of selling arms?
No. There are no international agreements. Well, there were back in the 30s. Many of the nations of the world after World War I signed the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which said we will not arm anymore. That was an official commitment to disarmament. The rise of Hitler, I suspect, is what did it in. And, you know, there was just finished last week in the UN a special session on disarmament. From what I've read about it, not much came of it. The nations of the world are not ready to pledge themselves to even the first steps in serious disarmament. And the SALT talks go on, of course.
Has the church, any church, taken any kind of a stand on the ethics of selling arms to both sides in a war?
I don't think so. Not in recent times. I don't know of any.
That's something we ought to address ourselves.
Yeah,
to.
I think disarmament is a major issue, but we're not dealing with it very much in the church.
In England, the selective objective.
Yeah.
During World War II, if a person was in the service and he decided, you know, that wasn't the thing for him, how could he?
In the U.S. or anywhere?
Well, you say, if I remember, you were saying that in England that seemed to work.
Yeah, they have a selective objector provision. I presume that applies to people in the military, too, who have a change of mind. Our law provides for general objection as a way of getting out of military service if you have had a change of mind or heart and can demonstrate that to the authorities. There's a prescribed system. You must be interviewed by three people. A line officer, a chaplain, and a legal officer. And a lot of the guys who tried during Vietnam War to get out that way, I think many of whom sincerely did become pacifists because of what they saw in the war, even if they weren't sincere, the process provided for that, and the process supposedly would judge whether or not they were sincere. And a fair number got out that way of all the branches of the service. But many of them said the hardest one to deal with, the toughest line, was taken by the chaplain, not by the other two. Time after time, that was the testimony we received. So, you know, how do you interpret that? It may be that the kind of people who become career chaplains are particularly comfortable with the military. They are not likely to be the ones among our clergy who raise questions about war or the ethics of war. I don't know. Again, I've talked with my father about that. He really can't answer it. He was in for only 3 years, never thought of himself as a career military person. Today, most chaplains are career people. There may be some of you in the room who've had experience with it. Dan?
The just war actually was really developed before the bomb and the possibility of war wiping out
right.
the whole human race. Yeah. My question is just, what is the meaning of war today?
Yeah.
So different.
Yeah. After the nuclear weaponry was developed, there were many in the late 40s and early 50s who called themselves nuclear pacifists. And what they meant by that was not that they were in principle opposed to all warfare, but that in a nuclear age, when nuclear weapons are available, there is no way that all-out warfare can be just, because it cannot. Nuclear weapons don't discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. The means are not proportionate to the ends. That was the basis for their saying, I'm a nuclear pacifist. Now, we've continued to fight wars for 30 years without using nuclear weapons. And, you know, we've called those limited wars. They've used conventional weapons. But the weapons are still there.
Yeah, it seems to me that, I mean, as Chuck mentioned at the very beginning, There are three options. There's a crusade option, which just asks, is the end justified? And if you determine that, then you may participate if you're a crusader. There's a pacifist option, which is clear enough. There's a just war option, but the development of modern weaponry obliterates some of the just war criteria. So I think one is either left with pacifist or crusade option, or that one version of the just war ethic that looks at a particular war and says, maybe, given the way in which its conduct is being conducted, I might participate. And that would be a war which would be conducted in a way that sorted combatants from non-combatants. Something like
there,
that.
There are
a few.
There are some students of American history and ethics who say the only truly justifiable war we ever took part in was World War II. Unfortunately, that's the war that shaped most of us in this room in our thinking about war. That was a good war, if we can use that term. Most Americans thought that was an entirely justifiable war. World War I was not like that, from what I've read. There were a lot of people who really questioned whether we should enter that war. Now, I think the fact that World War II was such a relatively good war seemed so justifiable, and that at the same time we created this vast military preparedness system that we still have, makes it difficult for us to detach from that. Many of our... I had a class in peace studies at Wartburg College last fall, and most of those kids had fathers or uncles who served in World War II. They did not, most of them, have older brothers who served in Vietnam. I think that's because of the class they came from, the socioeconomic class. Because the Vietnam War really used the lower middle class as the grunts, the fighters in Vietnam. Others found a way, legal or otherwise, of avoiding it. They said, when I asked them the first day of class, what shapes your understanding of what war is? Almost to a person, they said, hearing my father or my uncle talk about World War II. So that's still the dominant, at least for those kids, the dominant shaper of their understanding of war. I said, did you see no pictures of Vietnam on television? They were at the time maybe 10 to 12 when those television images were coming across. They said, yeah, we saw those, but we thought it was another show. It was another television show like Hogan's Heroes. And I suspect that's the way it came across for most of their generation. How fast things change. I realized that none of them was raising any of the questions that 6 and 8 years earlier their same age cadre was intensely into. These kids didn't care at all about those questions. They didn't know the draft. They didn't know draft law. They didn't know what we've been talking about this morning was no issue for them.
I'm amazed at the ability of Americans to have almost completely forgotten about Korea.
Just skipped over that one.
That's right. Yeah. That war seems never to have even existed in discussion of war in this country anymore. Yeah. And
we didn't even call it a war, as you recall.
No.
Part of the justification of that was that it was a police action declared by whom?
Truman.
No, not by Truman.
UN.
By the UN.
UN.
Yeah, by the UN. So our Congress did not need to declare that. We were not officially at war. We were engaged in a police action providing troops, along with other nations, to conduct a UN war. I'd like to ask Norm, if he's back there, what is Australia's law on conscientious objection? You've had a draft. You had a draft during the Vietnam War, and it became an issue. Australians had a draft. It became controversial there, too, and I think they even provided some troops in Vietnam.
Right.
They did have a draft during some of those years, the late 60s and early 70s, but they may not have had to go as conscripts to Vietnam. That may have been volunteers.
I would suspect that's the case. I do not actually know.
Okay.
There was a measure of movement in toward that in the Second World War, the early stages, where the conscription was for the defense of Australia, and there were a bit of a perimeter around it. And
the home force.
Who went to fight anywhere else who did that on the base as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
But there were ways of conversion volunteering, and that distinction was actually emerging.
I need three volunteers, you, and you.
Yeah.
What are there any Scandinavian Lutherans in the room who have had a different experience of that whole question of loyalty and allegiance to this government? Or are there Germans who had a different experience than the one I've described?
I'm wondering if you can make any pronouncements about what America learned in the Vietnam War that we could apply today to the race war, which seems to continue and which has all the same kinds of feelings. And I'm hearing you say that we got done with Vietnam and we're not at war anymore. And I think there are a lot of us who feel that it just moved home, that's all. it's perhaps more an idea of oppression than war, but the same kind of questions that you're raising about, do I rely on the validity of my government to decide who votes and who doesn't vote, who buys a house where and who doesn't, do I rely on the church's theology to decide who is gifted and who is not, and who is chosen and who is not. And I'm finding in our family a real intense difficulty in understanding exactly what the Lutheran theology is saying, or the idea of one God for one world. And could you come up with any ideas of how we can do this? Or do you have you feel that the kind of struggling questions that we went through then are not anymore?
I'm not sure I hear everything that's implicit in your question, but let me just respond, and maybe Larry has a response too. Last week we spent a full week, the two of us, on the global gap between rich and poor. And a lot of that had to do with the need for Americans and other rich nations to make some changes, to relinquish some of our present advantage in trade patterns, in economic control of the South. And I heard in your comment at least that suggestion that we continue with non-military means to want to control and dominate and manage the resources of the earth for our advantage. And that is a kind of warfare.
I want it to be closer.
But you were talking about domestic U.S. race relations.
Right. Right here. Yeah, on the congregational level, what is the Lutheran Church doing about the race war? How are we training people to fight in that? How are we persistently bringing to people's thought and mind the idea that we are all equal? And we've been having trouble in our family, even through the whole bicentennial, figuring out exactly where do we stand in this.
Yeah.
Who is celebrating this? What is it founded on? And it's a very deep and disturbing question to a lot of people in my family's position. And we've asked the question in a lot of places, and we don't really get any answers, and I'm getting discouraged about what I'm seeing the Lutheran Church teaching and its theology.
I think there are two levels that can be approached. The official statements of the Lutheran churches on those issues are pretty good. But the operative theology, what is proclaimed, what is done, what is behaved, may be quite different. I think that's also true with our statements on war and war participation. We probably, in areas like that, follow the culture more than we follow a distinctive Christian witness. That's my hunch, that it's easier when you're in a majority position and part of the establishment, as most of us are, it's easier to go along with the culture's values than to buck them. I think that's part of what John Schramm was talking about yesterday morning in his presentation in the Village Center. I guess I'd like to talk with you some more about that. The bell has rung. Mm-hmm. Do you have a comment on her concern? I guess I don't know the specifics out of which you're coming on that. Most Americans would say today, we don't have a race war. The law is pretty good. Things are, yeah. Well, thank you.